Please be seated. Thank you. Good morning, and we want to welcome students from Edgewood High School. Would they please stand? Good. Well, welcome, and you all may be seated. The students from Edgewood High School are here with the Caught with Class program, which is a national award-winning program that is sponsored by the State Bar of Wisconsin and this court. And we invite high schools from around the state to come and join us for an oral argument. Materials are presented to the students, and they may have heard from lawyers and others in discussing this case. And they come, hear the argument, and then participate with a justice at noon to discuss the procedures of the court in hearing cases and deciding cases. So we're delighted you are here. And this noon, you will participate with other students. We had students from Verona High School earlier today. And the justice who will speak is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. So now let me introduce Justice Bradley and the rest of the court to you. I'll start on my far right with Justice David Prosser. And seated next to Justice Prosser is Justice Bradley. To my immediate right is Justice William Babbage. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my left is Justice John Wilcox, and to his left, Justice Patrick Crooks, and on the far left, Justice Diane Sykes. With these introductions made, we will now turn to our second case for today, 01-3267 CR State v. Pamela Peters. And representing the state of Wisconsin today, Sandra L. Nowak, who is Assistant Attorney General of the state.
So, may it please the court, I am Assistant Attorney General Sandy Nowak, representing the people of the state of Wisconsin. We've all heard it on television every day since about 1997, probably. There are some things that money can't buy. For everything else, there's MasterCard. That corporation, the MasterCard Corporation, took advantage of a principle that we all know in this society, and that is that things that we value do not always have pecuniary value. Indeed, sometimes the things we value most dearly cannot be measured in terms of their monetary cost. In enacting this statute, the Wisconsin legislature reached out to protect two things that are of immeasurable value in this society. The first is an individual's property interest in his or her identity. I am who I am. No one else can benefit from my identity. The second, though, is a broader picture, and that is our system of this legislation was an effort at protecting our system of a digitalized, computer-driven economy, driven in part by credit, which relies on the ability of all the players in that system to be able to trust the data that is put there. So, in other words, if we weren't so careful about controlling the use of one's identity in our system, eventually the entire system might fall apart because I wouldn't know who I can trust in my everyday business transactions. It's the state's position that the circuit court erred in this case in mechanistically applying the doctrine of adjudicatum generis to narrow artificially the scope of this legislation. And there are three specific legal rules of statutory construction which get us to that conclusion. The first I'd like to point out should be no surprise to the court that in the drafting request, when the legislature asked for a statute here, the legislator specifically asked for a statute which would make it a felony to steal someone's identity for the purposes of committing fraud or personal gain. The "or personal gain" language is critical to an evaluation of this statute because if the legislature only wanted to get at those situations in which I use your identity for purposes of things of obtaining things with marketable value, that or personal gain language was meaningless. Second, I would ask the Court to take a look at the Legislative Reference Bureau's attorney's analysis of the draft of the bill. Now, reminding the Court that the analysis sections on these proposed pieces of legislation are required by statute in this state for a particular purpose. And if you've reviewed the Legislative Reference Bureau attorney's drafting manual, there is a discussion of exactly what that analysis is supposed to do. The analysis is supposed to put in plain language the objectives, the purposes, and the key aspects of the proposed legislation. The Legislative Reference Bureau attorneys are then also instructed that the legislator who proposed the legislation will take a look at that analysis and say, does this do what I intended it to do? And, in fact, in the analysis of this proposed legislation, the Legislative Reference Bureau attorney says that the statute prohibits the use of a stolen identity for purposes of obtaining anything of value. And indeed, it is the legislative intent of this statute to be broadly applicable, because the injury that this statute is attempting to address is not the theft or misappropriation of stuff. It is the theft of an identity. And I don't think the legislature really cared that much about what it is that was being taken.
Counsel, if I may, with regard to the legislative history, I have in your appendix page 127 the handwritten note that indicates, make it a Class D felony to steal a person's identity for the purpose of committing fraud or for personal gain, parentheses, see enclosed article. And that article then appears, an L.A. Times article, on the next page. And also following that is some legislative history with regard to California. I look at the L.A. Times article in the California legislation, and it seems to me to be dealing with monetary losses to consumers and credit companies. Enlighten me if I'm wrong.
You're not wrong, but the damage that they're trying to get at for the consumer and the consumer credit companies is as a result of the stolen identity, not necessarily the things that were taken. That's why the article recognizes, for example, or analogizes these thieves to digital body snatchers. That's why the article talks about the problem of the victims of these types of crimes untangling the mess that is created by someone else. And it just happens, I'm sorry, it just happens, I think, that the examples of how that's done in this particular article were through someone obtaining things that perhaps have monetary value. But I would also point out that, and I want to address the California statute for you as well, but I think also there is a distinction here in the list of things that we're talking about, that this article really talks about one's creditworthiness rather than a line of credit. This article focuses on the importance of one's good name.
So what I indicated isn't correct, you're suggesting. I indicated, as I reviewed the article, that it dealt with fraud, but only in connection with monetary losses to consumers and credit company. And you're saying, no, the article is broader than monetary losses to consumer and credit company.
That's correct. That's correct. And with regard to the California statute, that is another one of those tools of statutory construction that is going to get you, I believe, to agree with the state's position, because the California statute ended at goods and services. There was no or things of value. And under State v. LaBarge, in assessing what the legislature intended with the language or anything else of value, you need to look at when they added that language to the California statute, which we know was their original guide, did they do that because they wanted the statute to be more broadly applied, or did they do it in an attempt to narrow the application?
May I? Again, I see in this Legislative Council digest the California statute. Again, I think it can be read as only as applying in the same kind of context, that is, the context of the consumer in the consumer industry, credit card sort of thing, loss context. And if I'm right that's the context of the California legislation, and let's strain credulity and say, if I'm right, with regard to the L.A. Times article really dealing with monetary losses, or I think primarily, let's say, dealing with monetary losses to consumers and credit companies, why shouldn't I interpret the legislative history to be in that context, to monetary losses to consumers and credit companies?
I think you may be doing what the circuit court did, and that is looking at the actor's purpose as opposed to the bigger picture of the statute, which is addressing someone's ability to interact in this marketplace, to be victimized. That is, when you steal my identity, I have to untangle the mess. I may not be able to get credit. Now with in court systems like Wisconsin, where everything is a public record, people are looking up your criminal history or the existence of court cases against you if they're potentially going to date you. This is a way that we get information about someone. If you are going to rent an apartment, all of those things affect the victim's ability to interact in the marketplace. And ultimately, it could impact the business owner as well. So the victimization is to your ability to interact in this digital economy. The California bill is different than the Wisconsin bill in part because the California bill was specifically drafted as a consumer protection statute, and there were much broader protections than really were the focus of the Wisconsin statute in terms of consumer protection by breadth. I mean, there were more consumer protection issues. Wisconsin statute, I think, really focused more on what the article talked about was identity as a property. My identity is a property, and its position in the statutes, basically under property theft, I think highlights or would corroborate the state's position there. And I think with regard to another issue on the statutory construction, this is certainly the principle articulated in Outagamie v. Greenville, which is, in this statute, unlike another theft statute, the legislature specifically chose not to say what kind of value they wanted applied in this statute. They certainly knew how to do it, as evidenced by the indication in the general theft statute that things are to be measured in terms of marketable value. And certainly, since writing my brief, I did survey the cases or the statute. There are at least six places where the statutes specify pecuniary value, one of those being, for example, in the racketeering statute at 946.84 sub 2. So if the legislature wanted the statute to be limited to those situations in which the actor's purpose was pecuniary value, they could have said so. They elected not to. And under principles of statutory construction, the fact that they chose to do it in similar statutes and did not do it here evidences an absolute intent consistent with the state's position.
Could I ask why you did not cite the ethics code definition of anything of value?
I don't know. Just an error, I would guess.
Did you do a search of the statutes for the phrase anything else of value, as you did for pecuniary value?
I did, but prior to writing the brief.
Well, 1942 doesn't use the exact words, but uses anything of value, so you might not have picked it up.
Well, I think that's the distinction, but I did, and I think the brief reflects other jurisdictions as well in which they do assess anything else of value. And the statutory language probably isn't as helpful as the case law on the issue. And in Wisconsin, that particular phrase has not been addressed in this way.
Is there this case to me is like a lot of cases, a case of line drawing, but I'm not sure where to draw the line. I think the phrase anything of value is limitless, because what's of value to me may not be of value to you. You know, I value getting my work done. I value having clean closets, which I never do. So I don't know where we draw the line. Let me give you a hypothetical to see how this plays out. Let's assume that you are a college sophomore living on State Street, and you use your sister's driver's license. You're living together. And you'll use your sister's driver's license to get into a bar, because you're not old enough. Are you guilty of a Class D felony?
If someone elects to charge it, I believe you are. But I think that this is the problem with, not the problem, but the nature of law and why prosecutors have to undergo being reelected every 2 years, that it is a matter of prosecutorial discretion. And I would submit that it makes no less sense that that should be illegal than it would be if we said, okay, you walked into the bar with a fake ID, you now used it to buy a beer for, I don't know, $3. Mm-hmm. Should that be a Class D felony? And it's going to come down to a charging, a value decision by the local prosecutor. I would submit that by making the term value broad, the legislature intended the focus of the legislation to be on theft of that identity, regardless of what it's used for. Saying that it's done for purposes of obtaining something of value just means that I'm not stealing your identity and then I'm incurring some obligation. Apparently, the legislature wasn't concerned about that. But I would submit that the same reason that the MasterCard company told us that, you know, some things are priceless and beyond measure, but they're still really valuable, that people know that. And the common sort of definition of value is something that has worth, has utility, and has importance to someone. And I think that's all the further we need to go with the definition, because to get there, the offender will already have taken my identity, used it without my consent, and presented to somebody else unlawfully, either that he had authority to do it or that he, in fact, was me. And it's only after all of those intentional behaviors that we get down to the thing of value.
Well, go ahead.
And prosecutors just have to use their discretion.
I want to just expand on that, because I think that Justice Bradley gave a good example of it. It's just infinitesimal as far as what you can, because what is of value to Justice Bradley, I may not have that same value. But in this case, and I think the lines can be drawn, I know that your opposing counsel says, well, look, because we're talking about bail, and in this case, your opposing counsel says, well, if they had wanted to say bail, they would have said bail. But I think that when you look at bail under 969.001, it says bail means monetary conditions. Now, monetary being money value, I think it's easier in that sense of when we go to line drawing of saying, well, what Justice Bradley was talking about in the misuse of one's or someone else's identification for getting into a bar may be stretching things, maybe, and you're talking about prosecutorial discretion. Even there, I think you might have a problem. But in this case, just comment on, if it talks about money in the statute, it would seem to be more directly in line with the, quote, anything else of value. So, but your opponent says, no, that's not, because it's not in the statute.
Thank you, Your Honor. I think that Even if the state were to accept that the doctrine of ejusdem generis applies here, that the circuit court erred in not considering the fact that bail essentially is a grant of credit. It is, when someone is released on bail, they are committing themselves to an obligation to pay a fee, to undertake certain activities, and if not, they are held financially accountable. And in this case, so I think even if the document...
Well, excuse me for interrupting, but even if it's either a cash bail, I know some courts even take credit cards, but let's say, for example, it's a signature bond, but the signature bond is based on your representation, so the signature bond of $10,000 may not have any, you sign it, but there's a value, but if you violate that, then that comes into play also.
That's correct. It ultimately has a financial consequence for the person who makes that promise. And, you know, at the risk of overusing my analogy, if we go back to the credit card company's advertisement, I think there are two ways of looking at this situation. One is the value of Pamela Peters' obligation, financial obligation to the court, was $20,000 because using her own identity, there was a $30,000 cash bail set. Using Patricia Panzer's, her victims, there was $10,000. So we have a cold, hard dollar amount there to the tune of $20,000. On the other hand, equally, I think you could also make the argument that here, Pamela Peters' release, that is her freedom, her ability to interact with her family, to travel, that has a value as well, that freedom has a value which is priceless. And that's where the state maintains that that is something highly valued. And I think another sort of example would be, what if I use your identity?
But isn't that value, that's the value that Justice Bradley's talking about, which is a little more speculative, and that's why I'm going down to sticking with, if you want parameters, if you want definitions, it seemed to me to fall within that area, that there is a statutory definition of what we're talking about.
That is correct, but I think, and I it is correct, but I respectfully disagree in that. I think if you chose to make the decision under this factual situation, and allowed that sort of monetary, pecuniary value to be the standard, I think you would be artificially narrowing the scope of what the legislature wanted to accomplish with this statute. They wanted to get at people who steal your identity and go out and make a mess of things for you. Under the language of Campbell and the doctrine of ejusdem generis, it would be that the class of objects to which the general term is restricted isn't germane to the objective of the statute. It really is sort of peripheral. That was the way the legislature drew the line. They didn't say anytime you use someone else's identity, period. The only limitation they put was something of value. And I think the rule...
Ms. Nowak, my understanding is, and I think you refer to this in your brief, that Representative Schneider made the request here for drafting. And when he made that request, he made a request in terms of personal gain. I'm curious as to why you think that the legislation wasn't drafted that way, and whether or not you think personal gain is equivalent to anything else of value.
Thank you, Your Honor. I think the statute was drafted this way because the Legislative Reference Bureau attorney read the language fraud or personal gain and thought that the phrase anything else of value would encompass all of those things. And I think that's reflected in the fact that in explaining the purpose of the statute, the Legislative Reference Bureau attorney said or anything that it was anything of value. Didn't limit it one way or another. And I think the attorney thought that he or she was capturing both of those segments of it. And I think it's really important to look back to that initial drafting request, because if we limit the application of this statute to those circumstances in which I'm using your identity to obtain things of marketable value, then that language or personal gain has no meaning at all.
I understand that you don't want the term anything of value to be limited in the way that the circuit court limited it here to things that have some monetary or compensatory value. But is there any outer limit to the concept of anything of value? And I think that's the harder question, and maybe we don't have to answer it in this case, but I think that's a harder question, and some of the hypotheticals that have been posed.
It is the harder question, but those kind of difficult questions arise in the law all the time. What is disorderly conduct? At some edges of the where you conceivably could use the statute, it's ridiculous. But I think the dangers of artificial narrowing in that way could be more grave. For example, the hypothetical I was thinking about was, what if I say that I'm Justice Sykes and I access your children or make a decision that make away with your children? Are your children things of value? Are your ability to make decisions about your children things of value? Yes, they are. Are they measurable in monetary terms? No, because they're priceless. And I think that, if you look at what the purpose of this statute is not to stop the thief from taking stuff. We have statutes that do that. If you artificially narrow application of this statute, you're really making this statute in its entirely superfluous, because we have statutes that make it illegal to steal things with credit cards. This statute is about me pretending to be you and messing up your life.
Does it make any difference to the statutory analysis that what we're talking about here is really the mens rea, or the prohibited purpose of this crime? Does that make any difference to the analysis? I mean, we're not talking, when the term value is used in the theft statutes, it's usually used as a part of the penalty scheme.
Mm-hmm.
And then you've got to have some monetary measure, because the penalty is ratcheted up depending upon the value of what's been stolen or misappropriated. Mm-hmm. Here we're talking about the prohibited purpose. We're not talking about what level of penalty attaches. Does that make any difference?
I think it does, but I, again, think it supports the state's position. In other words, if I assume your identity and then assume your debts, as opposed to, in other words, putting you in a better position than would have otherwise been the case, that's a distinction and wouldn't be covered under the statute, because I'm not doing it to obtain something of value. It's probably a question for another day, but there's an issue about whether if I do something with the purpose of harming you with your identity, if I take your identity and go out and do embarrassing things on State Street, there's some question as whether that would be covered under the statute.
Counsel, you've several times said the purpose of the statute is preventing people taking your identity and, quote, messing up your life. I can think of many hypothetical situations where someone can take a document of an individual to obtain anything else of value without the authorization or consent of the individual, but it has nothing to do with messing up their life. My hypothetical of taking your sister's ID, she's gone for the weekend. Well, that's not going to mess up her life at all. So are there, but you said that's a violation. It could be Class D, it is a Class D felony if charged. But there is no showing, there is no evidence, there's no possibility of messing up anyone's life, even though I took an individual's credit to obtain or ID to obtain something of value. So there are violations that don't fit the purpose. What do you do with that?
Well, I would take you back to my initial comment in that there really are two broader purposes of the statute. The one is creating a property interest in my identity. The second is protecting our system of commerce, which is largely dependent on the reliability of the information that exists in all of these digitalized systems. And one of my colleagues, I don't know personally, but tells me that one of the problems, for example, of the with the Russian economy is that there isn't a system of establishing and maintaining credit. And so the economy can't grow and thrive because there's not a freedom of interaction, because they can't trust who they're dealing with. In our society today, where 100 and, might, may I continue? 150 years ago, we would have a business transaction. I would look you in the eye, shake your hand, and know that, you know, next week I'd be seeing you in the community. So there were all sorts of reasons why I would want to interact with you in an honest way. In today's computer-driven society, that's not the case. Hundreds and thousands and probably millions of dollars are transacted without any personal contact. And the system relies on, in part, on the ability or the requirements that people are who they say they are when they conduct these transactions. And that would be the sort of damage that, on an extended level, would arise out of that situation.
Thank you, counsel. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Mr. Rose, representing Pamela Peters.
Thank you, and good morning. I'm Terry Rose. I'm with Rose and Rose Attorneys of Kenosha. I represent Pamela Peters, the respondent in this case. If the legislature wanted to go beyond the monetary or commercial value that the trial court indicated was the meaning and purpose, they would have said so. And I think if the Assistant Attorney General were a state legislator arguing that this statute is far too narrow, ought to include a number of a whole host of other kinds of things or prohibit identity fraud in general, she would make a strong argument that this is too specific. But she is not arguing to the Wisconsin legislature. She is arguing to a court about the meaning of that statute. It would have been very simple for the Wisconsin legislature to prohibit identity fraud in general and say that any time that you use somebody else's identity for some fraudulent purpose, that constitutes a violation of Wisconsin law, and the penalties could be graduated from misdemeanor to a serious felony, as this is dependent upon what it is that you did. What is it, something insignificant or something significant? And going into the tavern using somebody else's identification might very well be the misdemeanor, whereas something far more serious would be the felony. But they didn't do that. They weren't trying to strike at that problem in society. And the reference here that she makes to what was in the mind of the proponents of the statute when they drafted it, one could either say one of two things. Either if they wanted a very broad-based statute, something caused them to say it changed their mind during the discussion, because that which was written was not which they started out to intend. Or one could argue that it is commercial transactions that the proponents of the statute were really concerned about. The credit card company, the bank, the merchant, the stock brokerage firm. And so they did, in fact, draft exactly what the proponents had requested.
Mr. Rose, could I give you an alternative theory?
All right.
Marlon Schneider is the number one advocate in the legislature of privacy. And all members of the legislature have to file annual reports with the State Ethics Board. And all members of the legislature are familiar with the term anything of value, because they have to report anything of value that they receive from people. The legislature has already defined anything of value in 19.42. 1. Anything of value means any money or property, favor, service, payment, advance, forbearance, loan, or promise of future employment. Now, that is pretty darn broad. And so when the legislature used the term anything of value, they had a point of reference. It's right here, and every one of them would be familiar with it. Now, shoot that down.
Well, I think that statute that you cite is for a different purpose, but even that statute limits itself to commercial or things of monetary value, obtaining future employment. They're concerned there about the legislator who steps out of the legislature and obtains a good job, a good position with someone, law firm, business, whatever, because of their support for certain legislation, or obtains a loan because of who they are in the legislature and what they have voted on. Again, though they are specifically there talking about commerce and money.
Well, but you have favor and forbearance. I don't know as that necessarily translates to money.
Well, as I understand, forbearance, however, would be that you're going to forgive a loan, defer payment of that loan, make some sort of more favorable terms because of who you are. My thinking on what the term forbearance would
well,
be.
Well, let me ask this. If bail goes from $20,000 to $10,000, is that a forbearance?
No, I don't see that that's a forbearance. Her original bond was $10,000 cash, $10,000 signature. It went increased to $30,000 when they found out who she was. But I don't see that as a forbearance. I mean, the court didn't start out with a higher figure working itself down. She wasn't given a signature bond from day one. She was required to post $10,000 cash and $10,000 signature bond based upon who she represented herself to be, Panzer, not Peters. So I don't see that as a forbearance. In other words, doing something that they might not otherwise. I mean, it would be very difficult to put I think it would be difficult to speculate as to what it would be if she were Smith. So,
but would it make any difference if it's something of value? And I know you argued, and I asked your opposing counsel, that you indicated that the reason bail would not be included is because the legislature didn't say so. They didn't include it, but by including the monetary in the statutory language, it would seem to me, or you can explain why you think it that's specific, talking about bail, because there are many other things, anything else of value. So you're saying that because they didn't specifically say bail, it wouldn't include it. Mm-hmm. I'm only asking that when bail under 969.001 says monetary conditions, it would seem that that would fit a definition, if even a limited one.
Well, it depends. If you look at the terminology of the statute, 943.201, it says obtain credit, money, goods, services, anything of value. I would suggest that the choice is not no meaning for the words anything of value versus an all-expansive meaning, but rather anything of value has to go back to such items as credit, money, goods, or services, such as an equivalent of a certificate of deposit, a mutual fund, a money market fund. When they talk about money, I don't believe they're just talking about cash in hand. But they're talking about the equivalent, a stock. When we talk about bail, we're not talking about things here of commercial value. I would suggest we're not really talking about
Excuse me, I didn't mean to interrupt, but I was thinking we don't use them often. We don't have them in this state. But bail's bonds person, that's a commercial enterprise that allows people to get out of jail or not to have to show up as long as they post bond. So there is a commercial entity that is involved in the bail business itself. So I'm not necessarily disagreeing with your position, but I'm just saying it seems to me we're talking about narrowing this, and you heard the other examples. But where there is a specific statute referring to monetary, Bail means either cash, could mean conditions, it could mean signature. Signature meaning that there is no monetary amount, but could be. So the point is, we used to have, when I sat on the bench, we used to have, what was it, the Vera rule? Well, it was for $1,000 bond meant you had to post 10%. Mm-hmm. And you could get that from a bonds person, and it could be posted. So that's why I'm using that in that sense of commercial, because it did involve a commercial enterprise.
If we did have a bail bondsman in Wisconsin, which we do not, I suppose one could argue that the fraud, that there is a fraud there on the bonds company, just as there would be on the credit company that lent credit to Panzer, based upon it was Panzer, but really Peters is the person involved. And I think that would be certainly a much different situation if there was that opportunity here. The trial court views it as anything of value refers strictly to commercial or monetary value. We are asking that be affirmed. I think you also should keep in mind here that just because you affirm the trial court doesn't mean that Peters or someone in Peters' position has no penalty whatsoever. She lucked out and pulled a fast one and got by with it. That really isn't the choice. She was convicted of criminal contempt of court. I would suggest that she could be charged and convicted, and she was charged and convicted of bail jumping. That's another possibility for this kind of situation. And the bond was, I'm sorry.
What about theft?
Could you be charged with theft? Not identity theft, but are you talking about the regular, ordinary theft?
Wasn't this a shoplifting issue?
I don't think that she could be charged with theft as a result of this because she, you mean because she obtained, I would say no. I don't think that that's specific enough. I think you fall into the same kinds of arguments when you're talking about identity theft, that she's not getting something in return. And the third thing, the penalty was her bond was changed. It went from 10,000 cash and 10,000 signature to $30,000 cash, and she ended up in jail unable to post that cash.
That doesn't make any difference. What we're talking about is the purpose for which she misappropriated the Panzer identity. Mm-hmm. So the facts of what occurred later are irrelevant.
Well, I was just suggesting that the choice is not either she be charged with identity theft or she goes scot-free. Absolutely nothing happens to her. And I'm merely giving you the alternatives here, that penalties that can be incurred when somebody does this. There are things that cover this kinds of situation. Maybe identity theft, 943.201 doesn't, but there are other statutes and other actions that can occur. That was my only point.
Even assuming we adopt the circuit court's definition that anything of value in this statute means monetary value, mm-hmm. or requires something of monetary value, how is it that bail isn't included within that? Because bail very often includes cash, and the statutory definition of bail is monetary conditions of release.
Well, I think what the trial court said was that it is the defendant who is obtaining the cash, the credit, the goods, or the services. They are receiving something rather than parting with something.
So how is the allegation in this case was that the defendant misappropriated the Panzer identity for purposes of securing low or no cash bail, and thereby her release from custody.
Well,
how is that not something of monetary value? She's either going to have to post cash bail or she's not going to have to post cash bail. She didn't want to use her own identity because she had a lengthy record and a history of absconding, as I understand it.
Correct.
And so she used the Panzer identity so that she could secure either a low cash bail or no cash bail. How is that not something of monetary value?
Well, I don't think she accomplished what she sought to accomplish then.
Well, that goes back to my initial point. It doesn't matter whether she accomplished it or not. What we're talking about is the purpose for which she misappropriated the identity. That's the gravamen of the offense, and the offense is complete once that's done. It doesn't matter what occurs later.
True, but I don't think that the statute here is aimed at anything other than the commercial transaction, the citizen's relationship to the bank, the stockbroker, the retailer, the service provider. I don't think that it is aimed at the situation where somebody goes into court and says, I'm Panzer, not Peters, and I want a signature bond but doesn't get it. And when they find out that there's somebody else, their bond is increased, they're charged with bail jumping, they're charged with criminal contempt of court. Why do we have to add also identity fraud when there doesn't seem to be any length? I mean, where do you stop? And I think that's the question here that has been raised. If you look at us, if the general public looks at a statute and says, what does identity fraud cover? Does it cover going into court? So that will be one of the additions. There's some obvious things here that it would cover, the commercial transactions, but perhaps it's not so obvious that going to court is the bail and
Let me ask you this. Mm-hmm. Would you want somebody, some criminal on the street, misappropriating your identity when he's arrested?
I would hope
absolutely
not.
And going into court and saying, no. I'm Terry Rose, and I have a clean record, and therefore give me a signature bond on this armed robbery.
Oh, absolutely not.
Right. Isn't that what the crime is here? The crime is Ms. Peters telling the arresting officers that she's Ms. Panzer and then telling the court
absolutely.
That she's Ms. Panzer. That's the offense, not whether she accomplishes any kind of a theft with that or any kind of a acquisition of something of value with that misappropriated identity, but the misappropriation of the identity.
Absolutely. I agree, but this statute doesn't say that. That's my only point. And maybe that's a problem that needs to be addressed by the legislature, not a court. That's why I said that I think that she makes a strong argument to a legislature. And if she were a legislator, that would be a good argument to say the statute needs to be far broader than it is, or we need to have a broad-based identity theft statute. But where do we draw the line then? That's the difficulty. The trial court says we're going to draw the line specifically at the commercial enterprise relationship with citizens, and that's easier to deal with when we're dealing with the bank fraud, the credit card fraud, obtaining somebody else's mutual funds on the Internet. Those are easier to deal with the statute. But if we add to this and bail jumping or the obtaining bail here by using fraud, well, that isn't quite so obvious. Well, then do we get into the more trivial here of going into the tavern as a minor, a college student using somebody else's identification because they happen to be an adult? Is that the Class D felony that we're aimed at? Well, probably most people would say that isn't really this statute. But where does one draw the line with anything of value? And I think that's the whole
problem. Well, that's
problem.
The question, and we ultimately are going to have to write an opinion.
Right.
So I'm looking at the opinion. And we can say anything else of value and apply a general rule of construction and say justum generis, and it means something like credit, money, goods, and services. And then we could say what the trial court said, obtaining bail isn't like that, charge dismissed. That's what you'd like.
That's exactly the position we are advocating.
We could say justum generis, and it's similar, and bail is like credit, or it is like money, because what you're doing is, in effect, getting a better deal on bail because you have a clean record with this false identification rather than a record that shows you've been in trouble before. So you could use the same definition as the trial court, I think, and reach a different result as to the interpretation and send it back saying reversed, charge stands, go to trial. Or you can say justum generis doesn't apply. I mean, this is only a rule of that's supposed to help you. Take the state's position, if I understand it, and say, looking at this legislative history, this was to not limit the concept to the itemized matters, but to open it up. So you say, okay, we're opening it up. That raises the question, and I'm going to ask the state this on rebuttal. That opens it up. That raises the question, how do you open it up? How does the court then define anything else of value? And it's tough to do because you don't want to add another list because you're going to forget something. And if it's too broad, it encompasses Justice Bradley's closet. Right?
Correct.
You want to do that. All right. So if we're going to get rid of justum generis as an interpretive tool here, which LaBarge did, then why don't we take the concept in LaBarge that says, hey, we're not going to define it at all. Court's not going to define it. I think in LaBarge it was what other serious bodily injury was. Court's not going to define it. The court's going to tell the jury, you define it. These are words of ordinary usage. You decide what they mean and whether they apply in this particular case. So what's the matter with that?
I think the problem is what does the general public know then? What is prohibited? What is the public supposed to say? Is this a Class D felony or not?
Well, let's take the public. You explain what bail is to the public, that she got away with a favorable deal on bail, and that the question that's posed to you, just like intentional is posed to you, or mental disease or defect is posed to you. Question is that do you think that this is anything else of value? And the jury might say yes, another jury might say no. But, you know, that happens, can happen on anything.
It can, but then what you're really saying is that we leave it up to the jury to decide whether this statute or any other statute which has broad language and is guilty, whether the defendant is guilty or not.
Don't we do that all the time? I mean, if you go to look at what even issues that we define or the statute defines, serious bodily injury or great bodily injury, if you look at the statutory definition, means great bodily injury.
Well, there are, I think if you look at some of the numerous new criminal statutes, that they have become broader and broader. She mentioned the racketeering statute. There are numerous statutes which we could enumerate that are far broader than the more specific original common law crimes which were the first criminal code. Now we're getting away from that. And I think that is a dangerous trend here, because what is the public then supposed to what is prohibited and what is not? Are we just going to leave it up to the persuasiveness of the trial attorney to persuade the jury that this is not anything of value because it's not credit, money, goods, or services versus the prosecutor's argument that obtaining bail is fall into those kinds of categories, and we also have the catch-all phrase, anything of value, here. Are we going to leave this merely up to the prosecutor's discretion, as argued by the Attorney General, that the example of going into the tavern is far too insignificant, for any prosecutor to deal with, except if that happens to be a problem in your community. Then it becomes something that is going to be prosecuted, and there are going to be examples made of people doing that and getting convicted of Class D felonies, whereas in someplace else it would be scoffed at and laughed at, as you wouldn't think of charging somebody with that. I think that's a very, very dangerous trend, to have criminal statutes that broad, when it is so easy for a legislature to define what it means. That's really all I'm asking for here. And I think that's all the general public really asks for.
Well, if it's so easy, you would just say it means something of commercial value, monetary value, or market value.
Correct. And that was the trial court's position, and that's what we are advocating here.
That's your definition?
Yes.
Okay.
I have nothing else. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Rose. Ms. Noah? So what's your definition?
Well, I think that we can rely on the jurors to decide if something has value. If I have to put a definition to value, I would say my jury instruction specifically would be such value is not limited to pecuniary value. Something has value when it has utility, worth, or importance. If you do not find that the defendant acted with the purpose of obtaining something of value, you should enter a verdict of not guilty. So I'll repeat that again, utility, worth, or importance. If you made me define it for the jury, I would say that value, something has value when it has utility, worth, or importance.
Or what?
Worth or importance.
I once had
utility, worth, or importance. Okay.
I had an armed robbery case when I was in the circuit court. It involved a defendant who held up a guy at gunpoint and, you know, stuck a gun in his face and demanded his property. And the only thing that the victim had on him was a single bill. So he handed that over, and the gunman fled and was apprehended. And it turned out that the bill was not an actual bill. It was a pornographic dollar bill with a little picture of a naked lady where the president was supposed to be. That was an armed robbery. He was convicted, and it was upheld on appeal. That pornographic dollar bill had no utility, worth, or importance. Maybe it was important to the victim. I don't know. But, you know, that was good enough for a 40-year felony, a Class B armed robbery.
The gun had something to do with it, too.
I mean, the question is the statute's focus, and the armed robbery statute's focus is on the act of violence in the taking of an item of property, not what the property is worth.
That's correct.
And the focus, as I read this statute, is on the theft of the identity, not the actual acquisition of credit, money, goods, services, or something of value with the stolen identity.
That's absolutely correct, and I think that is where there's a great quote from Justice Learned Hand about the cardinal rule of statutory instruction and how you can't use dictionary definitions to create a fortress around what the legislature really wanted to do. Here, I think the defendant and the circuit court, to an extent, bought it, used the doctrine of a iusdem generis to create a fortress around what the legislature really wanted to get at here, which was me or the defendant stealing someone else's identity. And if you think about, you know, the enumeration that counsel gave of what happened to Pamela Peters after she committed this offense, nothing that he mentioned got at her victimization of Patricia Panzer. Picture your Patricia Panzer driving down the road, you forget to use your directional indicator, you're pulled over by the police officer, and suddenly your life turns into a nightmare. You don't know why, but you're being hauled into jail, you may not be able to pick your children up, you're put through the embarrassing process of being booked into jail, all of those things. The mere fact that her security and driving down the road, knowing that she was a law-abiding citizen, the mere fact that that security was compromised is something which the legislature wanted Pamela Peters held accountable for.
And so it seems to me that you are eliminating an element of the crime by your response. What are the elements of this crime?
One is that I've used someone's identity without their consent.
Number one, use their identity. Let me put number two, without their consent.
To obtain something of value.
To obtain something of value.
Or is the state's position. And that I, in doing that, I represent that I am that person or that I have that person's authority to act.
Okay, so if I would say that I fraudulently use their identity without their consent, that's three of your elements.
Mm-hmm.
Fraudulently use their identity without their consent. Is that enough for this crime?
No.
You need an element of to obtain anything of value.
Correct.
Right.
Correct.
So it isn't just taking, it isn't just stealing another person's identity that is punishable under the words of this statute.
But I think that is the purpose of the statute, is to get at the recognition of my identity as a piece of property. The mere fact that the legislature could have gone broader and could have just said taking it does not nullify the state's position here. And they may have just been trying to find a way to say that I'm using it to something that benefits me, and that gets us back to that personal gain language,
okay,
that I don't do it for your benefit, I do it for mine.
I want to make sure that I understand your position. In order to be convicted of 943-201 sub 2, you have to do, the elements of the offense require more than merely stealing another person's identity. Is that correct?
That's correct.
That an essential element of the offense is that it be done to obtain something of value.
That's correct. But value is broad. And I think the state's position that the statute, I have a red light, may I finish my sentence? That the statute is intended to have broad application is when we look at the part of the statute that defines the behavior as well. The statute doesn't, you violate the statute if you present someone else's name, that one piece of identifying information. It doesn't require credit card numbers. It doesn't require date of birth or social security numbers. If I present myself as being someone else and use only their name, and that supports the state's position that the legislature intended this statute to have broad application. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Noah. Thank you, Mr. Rose, for your argument on a statute that we haven't seen before. That concludes our hearing in 01-3267-CR, State v. Peters, and we are in recess to 1:45. The students will remain, and Justice Bradley will be with you today.